Welcome to episode 48 of All Movie Talk. This is August 28th, 2007, and we have a great episode for you, as always. First up is a director spotlight on John Ford, the great, great director of epic, nostalgic westerns. Following that, a trivia question, and Stephen has a trivia question for me. Going to turn the tables as we do on rare occasions. Our top six list is going to be the top six unfairly maligned films, so movies that are attacked unjustly that we think in one way or another, and wrapping things up, I got a movie idea, and I hope Stephen is going to buy into it. I am Sam Stoddard.
And you know, it kind of feels like we've done unfairly maligned films or... Anyway, never mind. I'm Stephen Keller, and Sam, I have a pitch for you. How about this idea? We get two guys who really like movies and are really good at sounding like they know more than they actually do. Put them together. We have them talk about movies released on the internet every single week. What do you think of that? Call it a podcast. You like that idea?
Never work.
I think...
Who would listen?
All right.
Maybe it'll work, but it'll be a fad. It'll be over in 6-7 episodes tops.
Well, maybe, but we'll... We'll just go ahead and write off the money we lose from those 6 or 7 episodes, and that's a good tax write-off at least, right? I figure each one's going to cost $500,000 to produce.
Oh, I'm starting to see where you're...
Maybe
I like the way you think, actually. And you know, I'm thinking this might actually be pretty successful. This is a good idea. So let's just do a dry run. Let's maybe talk and just pretend we're going to act out one of these episodes, see how it goes. And
yeah, I mean, obviously, in the real, we do the real thing. We wouldn't have somebody like you talking, like me. And then also soon we talk about Blade Runner a whole lot. People love Blade Runner.
Yeah. Well, let's try it out. Orson Welles once said that he learned filmmaking from the old masters, by which I mean John Ford, John Ford, and John Ford. Well, I mean, an endorsement like that from Orson Welles, who made perhaps the greatest movie of all time, makes one, you know, take notice. If you didn't already, you should be paying attention to John Ford if you're a lover of movies. He was born in Maine in 1894 to Irish parents. And that's important because it does influence his movies later on. Some of his movies do have Irish culture in it. And he started acting, actually, in movies in 1914 and directing them starting in 1917. So this is pretty early on, and he began a career that lasted all the way up to the late 1960s. Very long career. We talked about Alfred Hitchcock recently, who started in the 20s and ended in the 70s, so a similar kind of length to his career. But... the IMDb has 144 directorial credits to John Ford's name. So as prolific as Hitchcock was, Ford was making about 3 movies to hitch his one. You know, obviously we can't talk about them all, so I'm going to pick and choose what titles here.
Wait, why can't we talk about them all?
Well, we could talk about them all. Do you want to?
So we should. Absolutely.
Okay.
Even the ones we haven't seen.
How about a segment on each one?
Sounds like a good plan. We'll be doing this podcast for the next 15 years to get through it.
Yeah. I'll hit the highlights for this segment of that. Anyway, Ford was overall known for his westerns, perhaps the greatest director of westerns of all time. I mean, there's a couple different candidates, but he's certainly one of them. And, you know, the western is a really misunderstood genre today, I think, because we've kind of lost the connection that this nation once had with the ideals that westerns were based on in this time period, the idea of moving west and starting a new life or seeking out some kind of dream. The Old West was seen as a time of opportunity, much like the American colonies were 2 and 3 centuries ago. In the 1800s, the West was this land of potential, and there's a lot of great storytelling opportunities, too, because, you know, civilization is slowly moving in. Not there yet, but the change is happening, and there's a lot of conflicts in bringing it in, and lots of things to say about it. And especially it's good for these epic kind of scope movies that have a pretty personal center to them. So it's a great genre for storytelling opportunities. Of course, a lot of Westerns are just these cheap, pulpy shoot-em-ups, but John Ford always seemed to have something to say and also delivered pretty first-rate entertainment. So his movies usually had some kind of social context to them. In fact, he's sort of an enigma in terms of what he actually believed socially and politically. Lots of times he was seen as a left-winger and making movies such as The Grapes of Wrath and so forth. But on the other hand, he consorted with a lot of right-wing types, John Wayne, and you know, had a very long career working with John Wayne. So sometimes they look a little bit more conservative. It's just tough to know. And you know, he addressed moral values on a personal level or more about a general way of life as a society. And so a lot of his movies have these kinds of things running underneath the surface. And he was brilliant at evoking the feelings that come with change, changing attitudes and values and societies. And if you're nostalgic for an idealized sort of time, he is just great at bringing out that kind of feeling in his movies. The love of the way things used to be, that kind of thing, and the necessity of embracing a different future. But as we talked about with Hitchcock recently, his movies aren't really message movies. They're, by and large, adventure movies that you can ingest on that level, but they're grounded in something deeper that you can immerse yourself in if you want to go there. He's probably the most decorated director of all time. Certainly at the Oscars, he's won 4, which is more than anybody else, although only one of those 4 won Best Picture as well. The interesting thing is, none of the 4 were Westerns. It kind of shows how Westerns are looked down on as a genre, or at least were. Much like comedies are, you know, it's comedies, we get the sense that they're discriminated against. Definitely Westerns would have been too. Well, let's plunge right in and talk about some of his movies. Actually, this I don't think we'd ever do this in anybody else's director spotlight. I'm going to start talking about his movies with his 95th movie, Stagecoach, in 1939. I mean, wow. He had made 94 movies before then. Some of them are lost, actually, especially a lot of The Silence, although one was recently discovered as just a few years ago. So you can look at his early career if you want to, but I think his first real big smash success and masterpiece would be Stagecoach in 1939, a real landmark for him and also for John Wayne, who was a veteran as well, but of B-movies and not really a huge box office draw. And with this movie, Wayne was kind of launched into the top tier of Hollywood stars. And Ford and Wayne would make good 20 movies together, most of them really good. Stagecoach is one of the most influential movies ever. I mean, Wells said it was the perfect textbook of filmmaking. He studied it a lot before he started making his own movies. The story is about a bunch of strangers who are traveling by stage, and trouble happens along the way, and these strangers have to get along with each other if they're going to survive. Now, if that sounds familiar, it's largely because of Stagecoach, which does this formula so well. Many great characters and lines and action and everything.
Yeah, I love Stagecoach. Though, you know, I kind of want to go back to a little bit what you said about the Westerns and how maybe we don't understand them today. I don't know if I entirely agree with you, because, you know, you look at a movie like Stagecoach made in 1939 and certainly one of the classics of the genre, and yet it's not really coming out of the 19th century. It may try to embrace those ideals, but I think it's distinctly a film from the 1930s and distinctly has the social values from the 1930s. You know, I hate to...
That's a good point.
Yeah, I think you always read a little too much into it, but I don't think it's necessarily wrong to look at some of the stuff that's going on in Stagecoach as being somewhat related to the fears of the day. You know, World War II is raging in Europe and Asia, and America is not really involved yet, and I think throughout Stagecoach there's this sense of impending doom as the coach gets closer and closer to its possible confrontation, and I don't think it really takes too much work to try and read that into being something of a comment on the modern time.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I actually hadn't thought too much about that. I have thought about other John Ford movies that do a similar sort of thing, because, as I say, he was always trying to work in some kind of social message under the hood.
Yeah.
As a lot of period pieces do.
I think under the hood is probably a really important distinction to make, too. I mean, Stagecoach is not an overtly political film at all. It's mostly just a really good story with really well-drawn characters and good action and good acting. But yeah, I mean, there is certainly a lot to read into it if you want to go looking for it. But you could also just watch it as a really entertaining movie.
Yeah. Let's skip ahead. Well, not too far, actually. The Grapes of Wrath in 1940. This got him his second Best Director Oscar, and this is one of the, I think, greatest movies ever made. I mean, it's beautifully shot, powerful acting, an intensely emotional story without being too manipulative. I actually think, at least in a lot of ways, it's better than the book, because it cuts out a lot of the book's clutter of ideas. The book is very expansive, and every other chapter or so kind of diverges into a bigger picture view than the characters themselves. There's a lot of stuff in the book, and that's good as the literature, but I think the human story is just so much more in focus and crisp in this movie, because the movie cuts out all that stuff and just focuses straight in the heart of the human story. And, of course, it looks good. I mean, the cinematographer was Greg Toland, who would shoot Citizen Kane the following year, so we get some great visuals in this really, really beautiful and stark and evocative black and white cinematography. You also get the sense as you're watching it that you're not only watching a great story that you care about, but you're also watching great art. It's funny, sometimes these two things are mutually exclusive. Like, if you're aware that you're watching great art, that can sometimes actually interfere with the more human interest of the movie, but I don't think so here. I just love this movie.
Yeah, interesting. I like what you put that about great art and like a great movie kind of interfering with your enjoyment of it. Well, I think what's cool about Ford especially, but really of the older Hollywood directors, the old masters, to riff on that Wells quote, is that they made great art, but like we said about Stagecoach, it didn't tend to be overtly showy. It wasn't screaming at you, hey, look, I'm a masterpiece, pay attention to me.
Yeah.
And all that. I think there's a lot to be said for that. I think that's why these movies remain so timeless. And Ford's, you know, his constant ability to focus on what's important. Like, again, you mentioned at the very beginning how Westerns, a good setting for, like, an epic feel that's still closely centered on characters. We have the same kind of thing here, where when you pare down the book and just focus more on the characters, I think that's, you know, that's an interesting thing that Ford is always going to be able to do a good job of.
Right. And, of course, The Grapes of Wrath. I mean, The Stagecoach is a great kind of entertaining adventure, and The Grapes of Wrath is a bit more weighty. It's a drama and everything. But, again, it still doesn't even hit you over the head too much. Actually, it was not well received by people who saw it as a really left-wing, strong left-wing political film. And today, I think it's you know, it's political, but it's not controversial so at all. I mean, I'm kind of a right-wing kind of guy, and I love this movie and what it has to say, so it's weird how political messages get received differently over time. Moving on to How Green Was My Valley, speaking of social messages, this movie is notorious for taking the Best Picture Oscar from Citizen Kane, which it should not have done. I mean, Kane is a better movie. But we shouldn't let that blind us to the fact that How Green Was My Valley is also a great movie. It's about a family, and more generally, the mining town that they live in Wales, and how life is changing for them. So we're touching on the standard John Ford themes here. It's not a Western, but it's very recognizable as a Ford film in that sense. And specifically, the way of life of a mining family in a mining town. So this town has been the way it is for a long time. Hard life, but it's a life that works for the people. And it's what they know, it's what they're used to, and now a lot of changes are coming into play. A lot of different types of forces just happening, cultural changes, and that impacts the way of life. I mean, there's labor strikes and unionization and difficult processes to go through. The whole culture's changing. And that's a tough thing, especially for the older members of the family to lose. The younger ones are more quick to adapt, of course. And so against this broad backdrop are these more personal stories, too, about a new preacher, a case of child abuse, a series of romances, and so on. A lot of different things, a lot of different notes are hit by this movie. And, you know, you really come to care about these people. So actually, this is pretty remarkable for me to realize in hindsight that I cared about the way of life depicted here that is threatened. I don't have the tiniest personal connection to life in Welsh mining towns, but you know, this movie is so great at putting you into that place and time and mindset. Moving up a bit, John Ford actually took a lot of the World War II years off from feature films, so he's pretty active during the war with documentary work for the military, and he was actually at Omaha Beach during the D-Day landing there. He filmed the initial landing and then landed there himself with the U.S. Coast Guard and filmed the battle from the beach. So he was right in the thick of it. It's a tragedy, though. Unfortunately, this footage seems to be lost. Initially, it was withheld for being too disturbing, and it was color footage, too, so, you know, it was probably kind of bloody, even, but it was locked away and lost track of. But after the war, Ford made another great Western called My Darling Clementine with Henry Fonda, which I think is the best movie about Wyatt Earp and the gunfight at the OK Corral, so check that out if you're interested in that. Walter Brennan is particularly great as one of the villains. Usually he plays in these Westerns these jolly old sidekicks, but it's kind of neat to see him chewing up the scenery as this really nasty guy. And continuing on with his Westerns, in the late 40s he made what they call the Cavalry Trilogy, these three movies about the United States Cavalry. They all star John Wayne, but the characters are different. It's only a trilogy in a thematic sense. Fort Apache is the first one, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, and Rio Grande is the last. And again, great adventure stories, but what really makes them come alive is the way Ford can just portray an ideal, a way of life, and evoke strong emotions about that. This is kind of an elegy to a time that is passing away. I just don't know how he does this, actually. You can break his films down and say, okay, this line, this bit of acting, this camera work does this, but why all those things add up to such a resounding whole? I mean, I think you just have to chalk that up to movie magic. Moving on to The Quiet Man in 1952, another great, great movie. My grandparents actually watched this one every St. Patrick's Day because it is about Ireland and Irish heritage. So Ford is, of course, making a nod to his own roots here. It's about an Irish-American boxer who travels to Ireland from America to make a claim on the family farm. And, of course, he falls in love with a woman there, but he finds himself immersed in this Irish community without maybe fully understanding at first what he's getting into. So it's a real culture clash that happens here, because there's a matter of a dowry that is being withheld, and Wayne's character refuses to fight anybody for his own personal reasons. He actually killed a guy in the boxing ring, and so something he has to wrestle with, and he doesn't want to fight anybody, but that's perceived as cowardice by the community. So there's a lot of these issues of honor and traditions at stake here, and a personal story about a guy trying to just, you know, figure out where his place in life is and how to relate to people. So I made it sound kind of heavy, though. The movie is actually pretty comic and lighthearted. A lot of fun. And the most memorable scene is what was at least at the time considered the longest fistfight ever seen in a movie. Kind of a comic fistfight, but it does come at a point. It's a real dramatic moment in terms of what it means for the characters having this fight. A wonderful moment. And I want to move on to The Searchers, because this, I think, is probably John Ford's greatest movie. Some say it's the greatest Western of all time. The Searchers, made in 1956. Steven, I know you love this movie and have something to say about it.
I do, and this is a really interesting, challenging film, especially for its day. I mean, the basic story is that John Wayne plays this Civil War veteran in the wake of the Civil War, who his niece gets kidnapped by American Indians, and he essentially goes looking to find her, and years pass, and she gets kidnapped when she's a young girl, and so, you know, all these years have passed, and he realizes that when he finds her, she'll be a young woman now, and have been raised by Indians, and we pretty much his plan is to kill them, and pretty much to kill her as well. That's a strange, dark plot for an American film, I would say. And yet it's handled really well. We have sort of directly confronting these ideas of racism and you know, this is in a way, I think, sort of a revisionist Western. You know, you play against John Wayne's type as the sort of, you know, pretty much on the side of good and justice, old West hero. Here's a guy who, you know, we fear like he's sort of getting revenge that might be justified after all these people did, you know, kidnap this woman. But on the other hand, there's this real savagery and brutality to Wayne's character that's a little frightening, and he's a dark guy who's really deeply troubled. And yet the movie does some surprising things, and it's also a really good, compelling story. It's one of those movies, too, that while you're watching it, you're really just swept away by the great photography.
Oh, yeah.
Shot in and around Monument Valley and some other places, just gorgeous, gorgeous photography, and Wow, an amazing film and such a challenging movie. I know we tend to think of Westerns as being kind of straightforward, black hats, white hats kind of thing, but not at all. There are plenty of Westerns that were much more complex, and I don't know that there are many from this sort of classical period, and the Search is sort of on the edge of like the classical Western, but it really feels like a very modern film.
Yeah, it does. There's all kinds of stuff going on here, and I think it's become more relevant as time goes on, certainly more in tune with contemporary mindsets. It was a bit ahead of its time, portraying such a dark and conflicted central character. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the photography. I have a note about that in my notes here. It's an interesting thing is that David Lean, and this is the master of shooting, you know, epics, Lawrence of Arabia. He watched The Searchers before making Lawrence of Arabia for inspiration on how to shoot a landscape. So, you know, if Welles is saying that he's getting inspiration for your movies and David Lean is using your movies as a lesson in how to make an epic, I mean, that's saying something. But we're toward the end of his career now. He started to make movies less and less often, and one of his last movies was The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance in 1962. Might be his last great movie. And, you know, it's another great Western. And it's also a great double billing of James Stewart and John Wayne together. Now, first of all, Stewart plays a guy named Stoddard, so obviously it's a great movie just for that reason alone. But this is another one of those movies that just shines. It's so well put together and has such interesting characters interacting in interesting ways that just as you watch it, you get that kind of charge that you know you're in good hands and this is a well-crafted film and it's going to deliver. It's about a senator who becomes famous for shooting this outlaw named Liberty Valance, but the public version of the story may not quite be the way it went down. This is an interesting movie for Ford because it's a bit more introspective than at least a lot of his movies are. I mean, most of them are introspective to a degree, but they also have this epic scope to them, like The Searchers. But this is a pretty intimate story throughout, and the characters grapple with these ethical issues about honor and truthfulness and living a life, kind of your public versus your private life, and when those things become quite different, how do you handle that? And it's framed, all packaged up, sort of as a whodunit mystery. So, you know, not at all the typical sort of broad expansionist kind of Western that we think of as the cliche, but yet another great movie from John Ford. So, hopefully I've persuaded you to seek some of these out. The Grapes of Wrath and The Searchers, I think, are probably his best movies, but he made a lot of great films. I mean, I've only talked about a few here. You know, when you do 144 movies and you're a great director, you're going to come out with a lot of good ones. His work is, as I mentioned, with Welles and Lean, influenced and inspired a lot of filmmakers. There's also Akira Kurosawa, Steven Spielberg, Martin Scorsese. These and a number of other directors have mentioned John Ford as a particular inspiration. And The Searchers was one of Sergio Leone's favorite films, which is interesting because Leone would kind of reinvent the Western that John Ford in many ways invented himself. So interesting situation there if you can put these movies in context in history.
Well, Sam, you pretty recently asked me two questions about Batman, so I think I'll go ahead and keep this trend alive and repay the favor with a third. Once again, about a Batman actor. And it's a pretty straightforward question, but the answer may be a little more obscure than you think. So I'm going to give you a hint. Well, one sec. But the question is, who was the very first person to portray the Dark Knight on the silver screen? And it was not Mr. Mom, just so you know. All right, so go ahead and think about that. Maybe you know.
Maybe a hint you could give me is how many frames in does he appear for the first time in the movie?
42.
42 seconds?
Yeah.
So he's right up in the beginning. All right.
I'm guessing.
Thank you.
All right.
All right.
We'll come back. So this week's top six, we want to come to the aid of some movies that we feel, for some reason or another, have been unfairly attacked. Now, these aren't all necessarily going to be great movies, and they're not necessarily going to be the most attacked movies either. Just six movies that we think have just been picked on, maligned, somehow unfairly treated, and we want to come to their aid. go in with number six, a very recent film. It was the 2005 Best Picture winner, in fact, and that's the movie Crash by director Paul Haggis. And here's I think, would be a good illustration of how this list is going to work, because how can a movie that won the Best Picture Oscar be unfairly maligned? Well, you know, obviously it got good reviews, good reception, but there's a real strong group of people that I think has especially grown ever since Crash beat Brokeback Mountain for the Oscar, that just hate this movie and just think it's terrible, and if you like it, you're obviously an idiot who, you know, can't understand films at all, and it was just a travesty that Brokeback Mountain lost, etc., etc., etc. Crash was a great movie. I was not at all sad to see it win Best Picture. I thought it was a good choice for that, and it's a really powerful film. You know, it's not the best of those sorts of movies that show these interlocking characters lives. We've talked about Shortcuts in the past, and I think Shortcuts is a better movie than Crash, but the big complaint about Crash is generally that it's overbearing, that it makes its point too strongly. It's about really about racial relations, and I mean, I don't think it's really about racism so much as the way that people from different races relate to one another. And if it's a little overdone, maybe, if you know, the examples are painted a little too broadly, well, it's a movie. It doesn't have the time to explore 15 hours of real subtle context. It's, of course, I mean, what movies aren't a little bit overdone in making their points? And I don't think that's a real fair criticism of this film. I mean, it is only up to a certain point. I think it's way too overplayed. So I think, yeah, Crash, unfairly maligned, a great film.
100% agreement. My number six film is another movie that won Best Picture, actually. And so we have another case of backlash against a Best Picture winner, although in this case the backlash didn't start until after it won. But this would be Shakespeare in Love. And I think the reason that it is looked down on now is, hey, this was very famously the movie that beat Saving Private Ryan to the Oscar. It was kind of a two-horse race, and the underdog won it. And I think now people look back and say, well, okay, Shakespeare in Love is this happy little period comedy. Well, yes, but it's incredibly well written and very funny, and I don't think it should have won Best Picture, but let's not overlook the fact that it is a pretty great comedy. I think there's a lot going on. It's very clever in how it mixes the kind of legends about Shakespeare with a real story about him at a certain point in his life, and kind of just playing around with the Elizabethan culture from a modern perspective. And I don't think we should be backlashing it, except to maybe say, okay, it wasn't as good as Saving Private Ryan, but let's move on from that, you know?
Yeah, Shakespeare in Love is a wonderful little movie. Yeah, definitely, there's this weird trend where movies get popular and then people want to hate them because they're popular. Well, my number five is a movie we talked about real recently on our top six dads list, and it's the film Life is Beautiful from 1997, starring and directed by Roberto Benigni. A weird little movie, the first half of which is kind of this really funny, sweet, romantic comedy. And then the second half of it becomes a story about surviving the Holocaust, and Benigni plays this dad who is imprisoned with his son in a concentration camp, and he shields his son from sort of the horrors of the Holocaust by pretending that it's all a big game. Another example of a movie that was well-received. Benigni won the Oscar that year for actor, and I mean, any time a foreign language film is a big success in America, you know there's something special about it, but there's been this real backlash of people who just accuse it of being a joke, of making light of the Holocaust. And what I said on the top six dads list was that I kind of understand how it could make you uncomfortable, but on the other hand, I feel like, oh boy, I don't know how to say this without appearing terrible, but I feel like there are certain subjects in movies that are almost taboo to address in a different way, and the Holocaust is one of those. And you know, I think Life is Beautiful is kind of daring in the way it does that, and that's what movies should do. We shouldn't just attack a movie because it presents something in a way that we're not used to seeing or that we may not like all that much. And if you don't think that Life is Beautiful, if you think it's making a joke out of the Holocaust, I think you're almost deliberately misreading the film. You're looking for reasons to get offended. And I just don't entirely understand the haters on this one. It's a sweet movie, and maybe there are some things that I don't love about it. I think, you know, obviously, hey, I'm the guy who anytime a movie gets remotely sentimental is worried that it's getting too sentimental, and so this one maybe walks a little too much for me, but still a really wonderful, special, strange movie, and I think we should celebrate it for its boldness and its audacity, and not just slam it.
Again, 100% agree. Number five for me, once again, another Best Picture winner, and once again, a very popular movie that received a ton of backlash, and that would be Titanic from 1997. How great The Mighty Can Fall. This is a movie that broke, well, it tied the records for most nominations and most wins at the Oscars. It obliterated the box office records, not just total gross, you know, domestic and international, and how many weeks it was on the number one at the weekend box office. And it got to the point where people were like, okay, had enough Titanic, I hate it now. Let me tell you, if this movie had made $100 million instead of, I don't know, 700 or whatever it made just in this country, we wouldn't be backlashing against Titanic. This is a great spectacle. Visually, it's just a marvel. It is emotional. I think we remember the love story and say, yeah, that was sappy. But if you forget when you first saw it, maybe, how much the Titanic tragedy itself has as an emotional impact. I mean, that was huge for me. I remember being very moved in the theater for the last third of it or so. And, you know, the love story itself, that does work. And Leo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet are both fantastic actors, and I just don't understand why it's now the worst movie of all time. I mean, do you?
Okay, well, let me tell you a little story about Titanic and my relationship. I was, when it was released, one of those Titanic haters, and I'm like the only person in the country, I think, who did not go to see it in the theater. Titanic opened the same day that Tomorrow Never Dies did. I remember I was in line, like, all these people there to go see Titanic. I'm like, look, I want to go see a Bond movie. I'm better than you people wanting to go see a giant boat. And then when it became like this huge, big deal, I was like, all right, I'm no interest in seeing this movie. I'm not going to. This movie's clearly awful. And I didn't see it for a very long time until I finally saw it on cable. And it, you know what? It's a great movie. I'm sorry. I'm really chagrined that I didn't go get to experience it in the theater. And yeah, so I guess I can understand, having been there, why people maybe hate it. But it's totally irrational. I'm not going to attempt to defend my previous actions. Rather, I'm apologizing. So my number four pick is sort of a classic film. You might be a little surprised I put it on here, but it's the movie The Birds from 1963, of course, directed by Alfred Hitchcock. Now, this is a popular movie, but it's not really that well-respected critically. Some reviews say this is one of Hitchcock's most overrated movies, and it's often considered by a lot of critics to be shallow and kind of poorly done with kind of cheesy special effects, and the acting is often slammed as being kind of wooden, and it doesn't have any of the psychological weight to it. Okay, so The Birds isn't Vertigo or Rear Window, I agree, but it's still a really, really great thriller, and I think sometimes, you know, it's sort of its status as a cultural icon of sorts really overshadows that. I've watched The Birds several times. It really, really holds up well. It's a really terrifying movie. I think of Hitchcock's pure thrillers, this may be the most effective to me in terms of the movies that just keep me on edge and just... If you're talking about movies where creatures attack people, this and Jaws, I think, have to be at the top of the list. Just a chilling movie and so well made. And if the acting is a little wooden, so what? The Birds is still a great movie. And I have no problems really ranking it among Hitchcock's best films. No, it's not as psychological as his others. It doesn't have as much to say, but it accomplishes precisely what he set out for this movie to accomplish, and with just remarkable effectiveness. I think, you know, just as a technical achievement alone, The Birds is really, really worth celebrating.
Yeah, it is fantastic. Maybe one of the reasons is that, you know, the creatures attacking people genre isn't exactly very well respected as a genre. And it is psychological. It may be not Vertigo, which is one of the most psychological movies ever made, but there is a bit going on here with the characters and the psychological story of the characters and their, you know, how they relate to each other and what they're trying to do with their lives and everything sort of mirrors what the birds are doing. It's kind of strange. You get this kind of parallel situation. You can kind of time when the attacks come based on when the characters do these sorts of things. You get the sense that Hitchcock is maybe even making a little bit fun of his human characters and kind of dwarfing their personal problems by having this outrageous external threat going on at the same time. There's a bit to think about. It's definitely not just a, hey, some creatures are attacking people movie. And of course, brilliant filmmaking, the sound editing especially, though the sound of those birds is just chilling. Well, number four, I got a great movie too, Schindler's List. It's a very well-respected movie, let's face it, but it does get some criticism and some backlash, I think. And I think it's only because it's directed by Spielberg. I really think that's it. If somebody else had made this, a no-name director, or maybe even some other well-known director, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Spielberg is held to a high standard, partly because of his previous track record of great entertaining films, and partly just because Spielberg himself is so praised. Let me tell you, Schindler's List is an amazing movie. I think it's my favorite movie of the 90s. And it does some great things with portraying right and wrong. There's one stereotype that's like, okay, everything's black or white, and there's this battle. I mean, that's the simple kind of view. And then there's a more complicated view, and that is the gray area where you can kind of understand them both. I think Schindler's List goes deeper than that and says, okay, yes, there are good guys, there are heroes. Yes, there are bad guys and there are evils. And yet you can still understand. Like, for an example, the Gert character. It's fascinating to see his thought processes work, because he is irredeemably evil, as people who survived the Holocaust and met him can tell you. But there's also some kind of weird thing going on, like especially kind of almost creepy, is the attraction he has for his Jewish maid. There's this one Jewish woman that he hires to work in his house so he can be close to her. I think it's pretty clearly that he's in love with her, but it's just so foreign an idea, because she's not even human to him, that he can't verbalize that. What he does is he wrestles with those feelings, and he's just absolutely baffled, and he doesn't know why he behaves and feels the way toward her that he does. And there are some great moments where you can see his thought processes work even without words. A great close-up, especially, where no words are used. You can just see him thinking about a philosophy about the way he should treat the Jews and rejecting it, all in one very silent shot. I mean, that's just one example of the wall-to-wall great scene after great scene after great scene in this movie. And people take the 3 hours plus of this movie and say, I didn't like the ending. The last 2 minutes are a little too sentimental because it reminds me of other Spielberg movies. Come on, a great movie here, and I think we should be respecting it for that.
I'm glad you picked this movie. I was going to pick a Spielberg because I agree with you 100% about Spielberg, even if I'm one of the people who tends to do that to him. I almost had Minority Report on my list, but he's definitely held to a much higher standard than pretty much anyone else. And speaking of higher standards, I really, really needed to include a sequel on this list, because I feel like movie sequels are just constantly being attacked unfairly because they don't meet our expectations. And I had to go with the most, I think, maligned, unfairly sequel of all time, and that is Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace. I gotta pick another Star Wars movie. Look, guys, Episode I is a pretty good movie. It's not great. It's not Empire Strikes Back. But if you hadn't had to wait, 20-some years for this flick, I don't think that anyone would have. This had come out a few years after Jedi, obviously, with, appropriate era technology for the effects. I don't think it would have been nearly as attacked as it was. It's just that there was this completely unrealistic expectation. The original trilogy has better dialogue than the new trilogy, I will grant that. But Episode I is still a pretty fun movie with some really impressive, cool action sequences and nice set pieces, and it's a good time. I think purely this is an example where people's expectations were ridiculously high, impossibly high, and they've just attacked this movie to death because it didn't do what they thought it was going to do in their imaginations.
Yeah, it doesn't have as good dialogue. It's hard to find the quotable dialogue. But then again, the original trilogy are some of the most quotable movies ever. It also didn't have, I think it suffered from characters with real personality to them, a fun kind of Han Solo character. It doesn't have that. But if you notice, all these criticisms coming from me now and other people are all about how it compares with the original trilogy. And the most outrageous are, Lucas is ruining my childhood, because they grew up with the original trilogy, then they see the sequels, and now those good times are apparently just taken away. I don't quite understand how that works. But, it's definitely an overreaction and unrealistically high expectations. And my prediction is we're going to get a rerun of that with Indiana Jones 4, which will not be as good as the first three.
It'll be better than the second.
No, it won't be. Ugh. Maybe I should be picking from my number three choice, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. But it's not. It's King Kong. It's Peter Jackson's King Kong. Yeah, it's the remake nobody really wanted. Nobody was really asking for it. So, here's my question. What remakes do people ask for? I mean, we get remakes all the time, and they're terrible, and nobody wants them. They're just made because they have branding. Who wanted the remake of The Hitcher or When a Stranger Calls? I mean, nobody complains about those being remakes that nobody asked for. They complain about them just in a general sense. Here's yet another one. But people seem to complain very specifically about King Kong. I don't need King Kong. I've got a 1933 classic movie. Well, that's great. His version is not. It's a very personal vision. It was, I mean, what more can you ask for from a filmmaker than to make a movie that he very personally wanted to do, and he put his heart into it, and if the results are still bad, they're still bad. But what I'm just saying is, it's refreshing to see a movie that wasn't just made as a way to cash in on money. I mean, he knew he was going to make money, but he's been wanting to do King Kong since before he had the clout to get it done. So now let's talk about the movie. Hey, it's a great action movie. It's got a lot of great visuals in it. I mean, it goes without saying, the special effects are fantastic, but wonderful over-the-top action scenes, and it's not better than the original, but it does improve on it in a couple of ways, like making the relationship between the woman and the ape a bit more meaty. I mean, there's more to it. There's more of a two-way situation going on as they get to know each other, and rather than just Kong grabbing her and her screaming. One of the criticisms was it was too long. Hey, I like long movies if they're good. I love seeing the visuals, even in the first half, before the special effects started, just looking at this recreated 1930s New York, the water and the ocean journey and everything. I love taking my time with that kind of thing. I had no problem with the running time. But just as an action movie, it delivers way more than a lot of movies that people hold up because they're held to less of a standard.
Yeah, I love King Kong. I actually thought about putting it on my list as well. I think it's a great flick, and I don't understand what everyone was so upset about. This is a great remake. If you're just looking for remakes that are made for the right reasons, here you go. This is a great movie. It's a lot of fun. It was one of my favorite movies of that year, and I don't have any problem with the running time either. I think it's a strange complaint. It's not like it's a slow film by any means. And yeah, you know, it's a great action movie with great characters. I would say that Peter Jackson is basically, like, I think the guy who's proven that he can do these giant spectacles and still really care about the source material. Yeah, I don't understand the backlash at all. Well, my number two movie is another pretty recent film. I think, obviously, they're going to tend to be more recent movies because as movies age, we tend to forget more about the critical comments that came out and get overwhelmed by all the praise. But I keep waiting for this to happen with Fight Club from 1999 by director David Fincher, which I just think is one of the best films of the 1990s. And I'm just waiting for everyone else to start agreeing with me on this one. But I mean, when it came out, it got really slammed really hard in some quarters as just being this ode to violence and masochism and misogyny and all this other stuff that I just think is all based on people just not quite getting it. I didn't quite get it the first time I saw it either, but after I thought about it for a while, and especially after I rewatched it, I really understood what the movie's trying to say. Maybe it's a little bit too dense in that sense. Maybe it doesn't quite make itself clear the first time through, but I don't know if it would work as well if it didn't. I think it's a deeply layered, complex movie that really, really, really rewards multiple viewings, and more so than most sort of twist movies, this one holds up really well under scrutiny and makes more sense the more you think about it. And it has a lot to say, and I think it says it very well. It's not hitting you over the head with its message. I think it's funny, you know, a movie like Crash does hit you over its head with its message, and it gets slammed for it, and a movie like Fight Club buries its message really kind of fairly deeply inside of it in some cases, and gets slammed because people don't get it, and they don't get that, when it's being violent, it's not endorsing violence. It's quite the opposite.
I keep thinking sooner or later people realize that it's not as good as... I think my wait's going to be longer than yours, though. I don't think it's endorsing violence, I will say that. I just think it's not a very pleasant movie to watch. I mean, okay, it's got something to say, but you can't get it the first time through, and the first time through isn't very fun, so why would you go for a second?
I think it's fun the first time.
Yeah, well, number two for me is Crash, and we talked about it. Back to you.
My number one is another just sort of well-respected movie. It's going to seem strange that I pick it, but it's Gone with the Wind from 1939, directed by, well, several people. In a nutshell, really praised movie, Best Picture winner, American icon, and it gets kind of slammed for a couple of things. One is that it gets slammed for being too slow, which I just don't buy. Yeah, it's a four-hour movie or something like that, but so what? That's the point, is that it's an epic, and you know, it's an epic that features a whole lot of character development. And then the other thing that it really gets slammed for is that it gets slammed for being kind of racist, which, its portrayals of black characters are not exactly the most progressive in the world, though I think probably better than you could expect from a lot of movies made in 1939. And if it seems like a love letter to the Old South, which is probably something not really worth celebrating exactly, well, I think that it kind of is, and it kind of isn't. I agree with that to a little extent, but also I think it reflects the ideals of the characters in the movie. I don't think it's a movie that's really endorsing the Old South, which is saying there were real people who were affected by it, and maybe the people who owned these plantations, who were slave owners, you know, maybe they weren't horrible monsters like they're often portrayed in portrayals that are more modern. Maybe these are people who were just part of a culture, and that was their culture, and they didn't see it as being this terrible institution that we now, you know, recognize it as. And I don't know, I think people maybe go after this movie because it's popular, like some of the other movies on our lists, and I just think it holds up well. It's just, yeah, a wonderful movie, and I'm not sure what all the backlash is about sometimes.
Too long is a really weird criticism, and it's one I want to talk about later in the podcast in its own segment, because it's funny, we'll watch Lost over the course of like 6 years and 100-something hours, and then Gone with the Wind is a problem at 4. Number one for me, hey, I'm going to double dip with Steven Spielberg. He's held to a higher standard. He's attacked more, so I'm going to defend him more. My number one is Saving Private Ryan. Now, I don't think anybody attacks the center of the movie, you know, especially the opening 20 minutes. People do attack the bookends, and this is typical for Spielberg. People don't like his endings. They don't mesh with contemporary sensibilities. We'll give a pass to a lot of movies from the 40s, say, that use similar types of sentiment in the endings, but we won't let Spielberg get away with it. But this isn't sentiment at all. Basically, Saving Private Ryan has a framing story about an old man who goes to a cemetery and remembers his experiences during the war. And one of the criticisms is that the character that, I mean, you find out at the end who it is, this character should not be able to remember everything that happens in the movie. Great, so what? Taking the idea of a flashback a little too literally, what he's reflecting on is actually pretty important, I think, to the emotional content of the film, and by the end you know what he's thinking about because you know which character it is and how he fit into the story. And it makes sense, the questions he's asking himself at that cemetery, you know, did I live a good life, and all these sorts of things, because of what's gone on. I mean, sort of how, what his place was in the war, and he must have felt a lot of guilt over that, and is still dealing with it to this day. I think that's an absolutely essential message for this movie to be making. I mean, I think the movie could make a lot of its points without it, but it just sort of goes a little bit deeper into the psychology of what the story's effect has on its characters. I think it's very, very important to have those bookends there. And Stephen, are we going to hear a voice of dissent from you?
Yeah, you sure are. Man, those bookends, I hate them. I'm one of those people who just thinks, you know, look, they don't ruin the movie by any means. Saving Private Ryan is a great film, but I don't know why Spielberg has to have these weird structures to his movies. Now, like, I would prefer cleaner endings. You know, when you're watching that movie, you're seeing with actual World War II veterans in the theater, probably. I know I was, and, you know, I just feel like it's manipulative. And those are actually really interesting questions that you bring up. And if the movie had explored them in any kind of depth, as opposed to these sort of superficial bookends that don't really give enough time to really explore them.
I think you can say a lot in a short period of time, but okay, well.
Okay. So my top six unfairly maligned films. Number six, Crash from 2005 by director Paul Haggis. Number five, Life is Beautiful by Roberto Benigni from 1997. Number four, Hitchcock's The Birds from 1963. Number three, Episode One by George Lucas, 1999. Number two, David Fincher's Fight Club, also from 1999. And number one, Gone with the Wind from 1939, directed by Victor Fleming.
My number six, Shakespeare in Love. Number five, Titanic. Number four, Schindler's List. Number three, King Kong. Number two, Crash. Number one, Saving Private Ryan. And we're out! Well, thank you, Stephen, for agreeing to see me. I'm really excited to pitch my new movie idea to you.
You're welcome, but be fast. I don't got a lot of time here.
All right. You won't regret it, I swear. You got a great idea to pitch to you. Action spectacular summer blockbuster called Boom!
Catchy title.
Yes, thank you. We open on an extreme close-up of a guy's eye. And as we pull back, it turns out to be an eye buried in a face mask. It's a guy with a gun, and he's holding people hostage in a big city bank. Outside, the cops are swarming everywhere, and crowds are shouting, and the SWAT guys are all over the place, all suited up, and one man, our hero, Detective John McBlane, a regular beat cop, shows up on the scene. All right, everybody, move out, he says. This is my crime scene. But the feds are there, and they sneer at McBlane and say, no, this is a federal matter. And McBlane says, not according to Section 12. Now, you and your boys just go over there. And he says, take my gun. And he takes off his gun and a bulletproof vest and everything, takes it all off, and he walks toward the bank with no protection. And everybody says, McBlain, get back here! But he just keeps on walking. I'm coming in to talk! I'm unarmed! He shouts to the guy inside.
And he's naked.
And he walks in. Yeah.
Wait, because you said he took it all off, so he's naked or he's not? I'm not clear.
No, he's got
he walks in, naked, no protection, and he's talking
Not quite naked.
Not quite naked.
This is PG-13, you know. So everybody looks all tense. I mean, will the guy shoot him or not? And he finally gets into the bank, and they have some kind of cool conversation, you know, with lines like, you know, I can't help you if you don't help me. You need to let a hostage go. You know, stuff like that. But the guy is all crazy, and he shouts a lot. And
wait,
he,
the cop?
The guy in the face mask with the eye,
okay.
And he's inside, and he's holding the hostage. He's all crazy. He shouts a lot, and it looks like he's not going to go along with it, but then he does.
But the cop's not crazy.
The cop's not crazy. And he's almost...
Maybe a little bit crazy?
Just to make it interesting, but no, we want him
to be a little Mel Gibson and Lethal Weapon crazy?
Yeah. That sounds... I like the way you think. You got it. See, you're working
on the same
page you and me.
That's why I'm behind
this desk. Yeah. Okay, so, all right. Well, he's ready to give himself up. Not the cop, the other guy. And is he going to let the hustlers go? And suddenly the feds burst out from the basement. They crept in through the sewer when McBlain didn't even know. And then shooting, and the bad guy freaks out and shoots all the hostages, and McBlain gets shot in the shoulder, and he blacks out, and there's blood everywhere, and everybody's dead. And, okay, fade to black.
Sounds like a downer.
That's our opening. No, that's the catch. We get some credits now. And, okay, we put up a subtitle 6 months earlier. Or maybe 6 months later, really doesn't matter. McBlain gets to the precinct in the morning, and he walks down the hall, greeting everybody by name, and saying things like, hey, good job on the Burton case, and I'll need the McDoodle files on my desk by noon. You know, stuff like that. It's a good atmosphere. It gets his character, you know. And when he gets to his office, his best buddy Leo is there. Best buddy Leo. They hang out. They have some funny dialogue. We can work on that later, you know. Leo gives him a retirement present. A brass-plated corkscrew with an engraving on it. That's going to be important later. So, anyway,
Wait, let me interrupt. Let me interrupt here.
Okay. What?
Leo is some sort of minority or wacky sidekick, comic relief type, scrappy young kid. Hot chick?
Yes, exactly. Right. We're on the same page. I mean, it's his best buddy.
Fantastic.
Okay, so then the call comes in. McBlain's family has been kidnapped. And we zoom in on McBlain's face. Oh, no. And the kidnapper calls him up and says, hey, you gotta do what we tell you. And he says, how do I know they're still alive? And then his daughter gets on the line and says, Daddy, help. But she's cut off. And then McBlain says, if you hurt one hair, I'll swear I'll kill you. And the guy ignores him. He makes some kind of demand. You know, I don't know. What money, something, it doesn't matter. We'll work on it later. But anyway, McBlain goes and tells the police chief, and the chief says to take some leave, and he'll assign somebody else to the case. And McBlain says, but he's got my family. And the chief says, you need to cool down. The DA's breathing down my neck, and the press are having a field day. You know, stuff like that. I don't know what it really means.
So McBlain's just going to step down and let somebody else handle it. I don't like the way this guy acts.
Oh, no. The McBlain says, then I resign. And he turns gun over and his badge and walks out. He's going to go... alone, you know.
All right, I was worried for a second. I'm glad to hear this.
Okay, yeah.
It's a good twist.
This is good, isn't it?
All right, absolutely. Well, then it's great,
Yeah. And then some clues happen. He watches some suspects and chases them around for a while. You know, I mean, we got the best stunt coordinator in the business lined up. He's got some cool fights already working on him. You know, anyway.
What about the sidekick? The hot chick minority young kid sidekick?
No. Leo.
She's with him, right?
We can get somebody else, but Leo's going to be important later. I haven't forgotten about him. So, anyway, McBlain's on his own for the moment, and he catches a guy and says, where's my family? And the guy says, I don't know. Wham! He smacks the guy and says, where's my family? And he says, you don't even know, do you? And McBlain says, know what? And the bad guy just laughs and he says, they're all in on it. The corruption goes straight to the top. And then suddenly his mouth starts foaming, and McBlain tries to stop it, you know, but it's too late. He's taken a cyanide pill.
So McBlain's family was in on it the whole time.
No. The family's been kidnapped. Everybody except the family's in on it.
McBlain, too?
No, he's not in on it. That's
what about
usually...
the hot chick minority young kid Leo sidekick?
Leo, we'll get to Leo, you know, I haven't forgotten
okay.
Leo here.
Because I really think you need to bring her back. I don't want to be staring at this John McBlain guy for 90 minutes. I need a woman in here.
Okay, he's married, and...
Uh-huh.
All right, I got an idea.
Okay.
will have a woman in there who helps him out, the neighbor.
And maybe he should be a widower.
Well, we'll get to that. Okay, so so the guy that he's captured takes a cyanide pill and he's dead. And but on the back of his neck is this strange tattoo. So he draws the tattoo on a piece of paper and starts taking it around to tattoo parlors and say, "Hey, do you know this?" And nobody knows what it is except one guy who's quirky and stuff. You know, he's got glasses, he talks funny. We can work on this, but he says that's the sign of the ancient order of the Takahami Buccaneers. And it turns out that the Takahami Buccaneers is the secret society of ninjas that sail the seven seas and secretly steal high-profile government fortunes and artifacts. Does that sound good? Yeah?
Ninja pirates?
Yes.
I like the merchandising possibilities there with ninja pirates. We have a whole lot of action figures.
Sure.
The what were they called? The Takahami Buccaneer playset.
Yeah. That's exactly what I was thinking. That was what I was going to just tell you just now, is the playset, but you were already thinking, oh, we're going to be a great match to work together. But, you know, I also want to say this is going to be really funny, too. You know, McBlaine's going to have a lot of cool one-liners like, "I knew today was going to be a bad day, but this is ridiculous!" You know, it's good stuff for the trailer. It's very catchy.
Oh, that is funny.
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah. So anyway, McBlaine sets sail for Japan in a big ship outfitted with special order machine gun cannons and nuclear flamethrowers, and now we get to Leo. Leo comes along, you see, because he's the last friend he's got.
She's
the last friend he's got, and late one night out, they're in the gloom. Not one, not two, not three, not four, not five, not six, but seven enemy ships fly out of nowhere and surround his ship and start firing their cannons. But
wait, the enemy ships can fly too?
Sure. Yes, that's what I was thinking, is flying, because that's more exciting.
Absolutely.
You get the fancy. Yeah. McBlaine fights back with his machine gun cannons, and everything goes boom, 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 boom! And the water is spraying, and the timbers are shattering. There's a huge storm. There's thunder and lightning. Everybody's all wet. The guys from the other ship start boarding, and there's ninjas dressed in black. Maybe red, you can see them better. And they're jumping all around and doing flips and stuff. And then a tidal wave comes and knocks the ship over, and McBlaine goes flying over the edge. And his best buddy, Leo, McBlaine says, "Help me out." And he reaches out his hand, and Leo just laughs and says, "So long, McBlaine," and pushes him off the edge. See what I meant when I get to that? It turns out he's in on it.
She's in on it, yes. I like that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so we fade out. And we fade back in on a tropical beach, and the sun is out, and McBlaine is washed up on shore, and he wakes up, and he looks around, and there's a woman in a grass skirt. Yeah, I got another woman in here.
That's good.
And a woman in a grass skirt here, and she's never seen a man before. She's a native to the island, and nurses him back to health.
There's no men on the island?
No.
Interesting. I like that.
So naturally, a little tension there. We get some kind of montage with them building a tree house and falling in love, you know, that kind of stuff. Whatever the women want. But then, ninjas are looking for him, and they find the island, and they come looking around, and McBlaine's been building traps all this time, so one by one, the ninjas fall into pits and caught in nets and stuff, and lions eat them, and there's a climactic fight in the treehouse, and the ninjas get kicked off it, but finally they overwhelm him and pin him to the ground, and the lead ninja walks up and takes off his mask. It's the chief of police! So they had a reveal there. You know, he says, "You always were a nuisance, McBlaine," and he kicks him in the face, and we cut to black. Fade in, and McBlaine and this island girl, you know, they're tied up to the bottom of a rocket, and his buddy Leo, comes up and says what her plan is. "I don't know what the plan is, but we'll work on that later, but basically they're going to blast off in the rocket, and McBlaine and the native girl are going to be burnt up to death." And so Leo walks away and gets in the rocket, and McBlaine says, "Hold on!" And he gets out the corkscrew that Leo gave him, and he cuts the ropes. And that's where the corkscrew...
That's irony.
Yeah, yeah, because Leo gave him the thing. Yes. So he climbs up the side of the rocket, and he screws the corkscrew into the side, you know, so he can hold on. And the rocket blasts off, and McBlaine's holding onto the corkscrew, and the island girl's holding onto him, and they fly up into outer space. They're in outer space, zero gravity, cool stuff, and McBlaine punches a hole in the fuel tank, and inside Leo says, "Hey, that's weird, fuel tank 3 is out of gas." And Leo looks out the window and says, "It's McBlaine!" And she turns to the chief of police and says, "Go out and get him!" And the chief puts a dagger between his teeth and ninjas himself out the door and climbs around. There's this huge fight outside the rocket, and and zero gravity effects, and there's some punches, and the chief punches, and McBlaine punches, and the chief punches, and finally McBlaine punches the chief right in the dagger in his mouth. So McBlaine cuts up his hand really bad, but the chief gets his face sliced open, you know. We'll work on the right amount of blood here, but anyway, he takes it like a man, the fist to the, and it's worth it because the chief lets go of the rocket and screams and falls off, and burns up in the Earth's atmosphere. So that's the end of the chief. And then McBlaine goes into the rocket, and Leo says, "McBlaine, did anyone ever tell you you have a nasty habit of staying alive?" I thought it was a good line.
You would be clever. You could play the Bee Gees song, "Staying Alive," during that part.
Oh, that would be funny. Add a little humor to the tension. I like it. I like it. In fact, I was thinking of that, but you thought of it better. So
Plus, the rights are cheap to the song. Not that expensive.
Oh, good, perfect, yes, and it's a very popular song. Okay, well, Leo does some ninja stuff, and McBlaine gets beat around some, you know, they bump around the controls, and the rocket spirals out of control, and Leo gets McBlaine pinned, and he raises his flame bazooka thrower gun, and is about to pull the trigger when McBlaine kicks the switchboard, and the rocket turns into a dive, and Leo gets thrown back, and McBlaine kicks him out the window, and he gets drenched in the leaking fuel, and the afterburners light him up, and he explodes in a big earth-shattering boom! But now the rocket is about to crash land in the Antarctic. I mean, hey, penguins are big money. Don't forget Happy Feet, $200 million worldwide. Anyway, McBlaine is about to bail out of the rocket into Antarctica, but the last second he hears a muffled cry for help. It's his family locked away in the compartment in the rocket, bound and gagged, and he rips the door open and pulls them all out, and everybody bails out just in time, and the rocket explodes in a big kaboom! And everybody ducks and covers as the debris rains down when the smoke clears. I don't know, somebody's dead, maybe the wife, maybe the island girl, one of them dies, making it okay for him to be with the other one.
I thought McBlaine was a widower.
So, yeah, right, he's a widower, so either his wife dies or the island girl dies, making it okay for him to be the other one. You know, we can work, we try both endings out on test audiences and see what they like better. I mean, whichever one dies, you know.
So it's a love triangle, too.
Yeah. Right, a widower in a love triangle with his wife and the island girl.
I like it.
Yeah, but one of them dies. Whichever one, it's really sad, you know. But we wrap it up, and the penguins nurse everybody back to health, and we cut to some scenes of normal life resuming back home, and the cops reinstate McBlaine, but he's spending more time at home now. You see, he finally makes it to his daughter's recitals and stuff. I don't know. You know, some random happy stuff. We can work on that later. But then there's this big kaboom, and that's when we cut to the credits.
I like it. I like the kaboom at the end. That's important. But I think you need another twist. What if it turns out that the chief of police or the hot chick young kid minority is also the guy from the start inside the bank?
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
No one would see that coming.
Yeah.
That way it ties everything together. That's what they call economy of script or something. I don't know. I heard that phrase once. I'm not sure what it means. All right, well, I like it.
We got a deal on this?
Yeah, you have anyone attached for it? Who's going to play McBlaine?
Yes, we have somebody attached. They're just lining up for this. We got three or four or seven different stars that were very interested. I have the list somewhere.
I was thinking Will Ferrell in a dramatic role.
Oh, yes, sure.
He can do that. I saw Stranger Than Fiction. He can be serious, and the kids love him.
Stranger Than Fiction, $10 million worldwide. He can't knock that. So maybe we can meet next week. I got this other idea, too. It's about a bunch of teenagers that go into the woods, and they get ripped apart. It's good. The guy doing it, it turns out he's twins conjoined at the neck, and at the end he gets decapitated.
Ooh, sounds spooky.
They both.
All right, so if you remember from earlier on, we're continuing our Batman trivia theme. I don't know if it's like a Batman month or something, but the question is, who was the very first person to portray the Dark Knight in film?
See, what you want me, and you gave me the clue that it's not Michael Keaton, right?
Right.
Right. But what you're steering me toward is that you got a trap here. You want me to say Adam West, because that would be somebody I knew played Batman before, although he was on TV, but there was that movie. Was it a TV movie or theater movie? I don't remember.
Theatrical.
But I'm pretty sure that cannot possibly be right, because then it wouldn't be that interesting a trivia question, right?
Let me give you a hint. maybe this will help you, maybe it won't. He's the father of a producer who helped create another great macho action franchise.
Okay. Alan Ladd.
No.
He at least was an actor who was the father of a producer, so oh well.
That is a good try. No, and in fact, you're probably not too far off in terms of timelines either. The first Batman movie was made in 1943, called The Batman. It was released as a 15-part serial, and Batman was played by a guy named Lewis Wilson. And his career is kind of undistinguished, except for the fact that he was the father of Michael G. Wilson, one of the producers who helped create the James Bond series, as you well know. So yeah, all the way back in the 1940s, there were Batman movies.
You asked that just so I would get it wrong, didn't you? It's a Bond question, really.
Maybe.
This is payback for last week, isn't it? It's not my fault you didn't know the answer.
Right, nor is it your fault that you didn't know last week. This week, I mean, who hasn't seen that great 1943 serial of The Batman? I know I have the DVD.
That's it for episode 48. Come back next week, we'll have episode 49. But in the meantime, go to our website, allmovietalk.com. That's I think there's a K in it somewhere, .com. Anyway, that'll take you to our website, where we have more discussion about movies than we get to on the show. And also check out rinkworks.com, RINKWORKS.com, for a bunch of movie-related things and other entertainment as well, some games, some humor, puzzles and stuff. So that'll keep you busy until our next episode. Tell us about it, Stephen.
Well, we'll be doing a film style spotlight all about some of my favorite movies and yours too, Sam. Screwball comedies.
Oh, cool.
Everyone loves a good screwball, even if most people don't have an idea what the word actually means. They still do like to use it. And if you're feeling lucky at home, prepare your top six list for the top six gambling movies, because that will be our top six list when we come back next week on September 4th.
You can even have gambling pools with your office mates about what's going to be on our gambling list. But then, after the credits, just when you think it's all over, this guy jumps out of nowhere and says, "Cut!"